I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Lisa Cornwell joins me. She is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir of sexism, retaliation, and the fight they didn't see coming. If you haven't seen the cover, it's out. Very excited to have her here with us. This was a really quick read for me. I think a quick read because it's compelling, but also because you made it very relatable, your life story, and then kind of drew people in with your background to what ultimately happened to your experience at Golf Channel. But I kind of want to lead with, at what point did you decide you were going to write this? And I feel like I'm asking that as someone who's always curious why people decide to put pen to paper and decide to write something so personal and put it out there for the world to experience.
Well, it's interesting, Ryan. First of all, thanks for having me. You know, in my dedication, I said one of the people I dedicated this book to was my mom, who's always wanted me to write a book. She said, "Lisa, you know, you've had all these incredible stories. You really need to put them out there." And I thought, nobody wants to read a book by me. You know, I don't have that much to say. And, you know, there were some things that happened even pre-Golf Channel, as you know from reading it, that that were important for me to talk about, things that I've been through. I talk about an eating disorder, my burnout from golf. I think a lot of things that everyday human beings, whether you're male, female, whatever, we're not immune to it. Just life kind of gets in the way. And so I think from that regard, I always kind of thought about possibly putting it out there and sharing my story in the hopes that maybe it could help somebody else with his or her story. And then the Golf Channel part rolled along. And I noticed when I spoke out, and I'm sure that you saw this, when I put that first public tweet out on January 1, 2021, when I wasn't in contract, that I was trying to get this message out via social media, which is absolutely no way to put out a social put out information or your experiences, especially when they're so long and drawn out. But I was attempting to, and I was really angry. And then as time was going on, even though I was involved in this legal case, you know, I didn't know how much that I could say, but I thought, you know, regardless, I don't know if I'm going to pursue this down the line if the EEOC doesn't take the case, just because of the sheer expense of it. So I reached out to Tucker and I thought, okay, let's at least sort of start this process, you know, with the proposal and get everything in order. And then lo and behold, it just kind of fell in line. But yeah, it took a little bit to be fully committed, but look, at least in the beginning, it was very cathartic. It was a good outlet for me and certainly better than going to Twitter.
Did you have a fair percentage of this done before you even really decided that you wanted it to be a book? Did you do any kind of writing or journaling or note-taking of, not just to be contemporaneous for an EEOC case, but because you wanted to kind of have a documentation of what you've experienced these last few years?
Well, I had a lot of notes because of the EEOC case. So from the Golf Channel perspective, that was pretty easy to put together. And I will say, when it came to that part in the book, Tucker did a lot of the heavy lifting, because how do you write a story about a legal case and make it compelling? And that's really where Tucker stood out and did a good job, I think. So once we actually got the deal, I did more of the early writing in the book where it was more about my life and, you know, experiences, because that can't really come from somebody else. And that's pretty easy to tell. You know, the chapters aren't long. I try to go into as much detail as I can recall to share it. But yeah, no, we didn't have a lot of it written. I mean, once we got the book deal, that's kind of when we went fast and furious. And I think that it was last April, and literally we had to have the manuscript turned in by September. So, you know, I had started a podcast and I literally had to put everything aside. So I was writing nonstop and doing PGA Tour Live, and that's it. I mean, I stopped doing yard work, Ryan, which is a big deal for me. That's my therapy. So everything else went away, even golf. I barely played golf. So it's kind of like, it was a great experience. I'm not a writer by trade. I'm one and done. So I'm glad that we're in the process now of talking about it rather than the writing and editing portion of it.
You brought up Tucker Dale Booth or Tucker Booth. If you know him on Twitter, you know him. But if you don't, can you kind of give people a background on how you got in touch with Tucker and how you collaborated with him and what that discussion might have been like up front of how you were going to work together?
Yeah, so he had never written a book, and I saw that he had tweeted out something about Michael Whalen. It was a profile piece on Michael and the sort of what he went through, not only with Golf Channel, but his personal battles with mental health issues. And as I started reading this, I was just captivated by it. I was fascinated as much by the story, but the storytelling aspect and the way that Tucker presented it. I knew at that point that I couldn't afford to go hire a seasoned ghostwriter or co-author. Tucker had never written a book. He had actually reached out to me after I put out that tweet on January 1st and asked me to come on his podcast. And that's when I started researching him, and I came across that profile piece, and we had a discussion, and I knew immediately. I thought, you know, if I do end up writing a book, this is the guy I want to help me do it, because his voice just really spoke to me through those words. And, you know, since then he's become like a brother to me. I love Tucker. He has gone to battle for me. He believed in this whole story from day one. And I will say he vetted me, you know, it was, and I encouraged him to do so. He said, if I'm going to write a book with you and put my name on it, I want to make sure that you're legitimate. And I said, absolutely. You know, please call around, ask around, dig deep, and then let's talk again. And we did.
What has the response been? And keeping in mind that social media is the weirdest place in the world. but what is the kind of the spectrum of the response been from maybe people who are in this line of work, whether that's TV writing, some form of media, versus people who are outside that line of work, men versus women? I mean, what has there been a gamut of kind of range of responses based on where people come from in life?
They've really been pretty equal. And a lot of people knew that I think the claims and the accusations that I were making were real, just because, you know, if you understand the culture at Golf Channel, it doesn't surprise you. It doesn't surprise anyone, man or woman, what can happen in corporate America. I will say some of the feedback that has meant the most to me have been the select number of folks who I used to work with who have read it. And I got a message from somebody who I worked with in studio, who was part of the crew, the floor crew. And the response was, like, I knew that there were things going on. I didn't know all this happened. You hid it from us very well. And, you know, thanks for standing up for all of us. And it was a heartwarming, not as much about the book, but just about our relationships and the bonds and friendships that we all formed. And, you know, to be able to do our jobs and to work and enjoy each other despite the chaos, I think that it was a good reminder of that, because I did love my job. You know, I did love the people I worked with. I did love covering golf. And, you know, I miss those folks. And so I think that response has been great. But a lot of it has been kind of what you said, too. It was an easy read. It was a quick read. I'm not one of those people who tries to go to thesaurus and use, you know, big words and, you know, to try to sound like I went to Harvard, because I didn't. I'm very proud of, you know, my Southern education, SEC education. So, I think the response has been, thanks for putting all this out there, because we didn't quite understand, but now we do.
Do you wish, based on that response, that maybe you would have put it out there to other people that were your coworkers at the time, that it might have been a help somehow, either emotionally as you're going through this, probably feel like you're on an island in some sense, or even from a management perspective going to bat for you?
So, you know, I really try not to have a lot of regrets. But with everything that happened with Golf Channel, I do have one regret, and that's not going to HR when there was a clear violation of employment law, and that being in terms of my relationship with Sarah and how they handled that and trying to take me off of covering a women's event for false accusations. So, you know, it was on the heels of the Angela Aiken, Sergio Garcia fallout, and people will read that. Those chapters really are close together. And for folks who don't know about the story, and most of them won't, because Angela, she spoke out a little bit, but not a lot. But, you know, in the end, ended up losing her job because she was in a relationship that she didn't disclose with Sergio Garcia, which was ridiculous. I mean, Angela was so good at her job. She was fair. She was objective. She didn't do anything to cross the lines. And then I follow up and kind of deal with sort of the same thing, but how they handled it on the back end with me, given the fact that I disclosed everything that I should have disclosed, I went, you know, but I shouldn't have even had to disclose it. First of all, that was ridiculous, but it's kind of hard to talk about without giving the story away, but it's a really important part of the book to me. And it's with Golf Channel, the one regret that I didn't have, not going to HR, but maybe contacting a lawyer at that point and handling it the way that it should have been handled, because it was a serious matter.
Do you think that things would have gone differently for you had things not happened the way they did for Angela ahead of you or around the same time as you?
No, I think eventually it would have happened to me. And here's why, because if you're a woman at Golf Channel and you speak out, you're not going to have a long history there. And I say that because I'm not the only one who that happened to. I mean, there is a parade of women who have been outspoken, who have tried to fight back on wrongdoings, and eventually they're shown the door. I mean, we talked about Chelsea Kite in the book, and Chelsea wrote that one aspect from her own words, and look what happened to her. She went to HR, she spoke out about it. She tried to go against her bosses who were clearly trying to do her harm in her job. And she was asked to leave. She wasn't renewed. So it's not just me. It's not just Chelsea. There are numerous counts of women, all of whom, or many of whom, came to me after I spoke out and said, you know, this happened to me too. And it's unfortunate. It's heartbreaking to know that these things happen to hard workers, people who cared about their jobs. And that's why I think it's important to get the story out there.
What is it about media, maybe Golf Channel specifically, / NBC Universal, that created a retaliatory environment for so many people, including yourself?
It's just that old boys club culture. And I say that in the fact that, you know, our main boss was a woman, but she was part of the boys club. So it's not just always a male issue. I mean, you know, I talk about in there that she's the biggest disappointment of my professional career, because as a woman going into a sports network, you know, you have all of these expectations and sort of breathe a sigh of relief thinking, okay, there's a woman in charge. We're not going to fight the same battles, when in essence, I fought the biggest battles that I've ever fought in sports media with a woman in charge, because she so badly wanted to remain part of the boys club that she overlooked everything. And it made it worse for all of us. And, you know, truthfully, it made it worse for her too. We wrote in the book about how when you do that as a woman, you basically become a pawn. And people know that they can manipulate you. They know that they can take advantage of you. And they did. And like, there are a lot of unfortunate angles and sides to this story. And that's why I really hope everybody will read it, and with those things in mind, and put it all together, kind of like you did. It doesn't take a genius to figure out what happened. You know, it's right there in front of you. The stories are right there. They're all verifiable. Nothing that I put in the book happened to just me. You know, I mean, people know about all these accounts. And so that's why I will fully stand behind any sort of backlash or allegations or charges, because, you know, you can't fight the truth.
Has there been any kind of response from NBC Universal or Golf Channel to you, publicly or privately, having seen what you've written, or, you know, ahead of it being available for public sale?
They haven't read it, not to my knowledge. So it's not available until May 23rd. And we've been very careful in that regard in terms of who we've sent out galley copies to and let read it, because like they'll eventually read it. They'll see what's in there. I spell it all out. I name a lot of names. I think that Molly's name's mentioned over 120 times. Her husband's name's mentioned over 130 times. There's a chapter devoted to Brandel Chamblee. So, you know, they're all going to read it, and they'll read it very soon. So I can tell you this, I wouldn't want my name mentioned in a book like that, but I don't think my name ever will be, because I know how to treat people right. It's not really that difficult. So I think that, you know, in essence, that's kind of the moral of the story. Just do the right thing, treat people right, and you won't be a chapter or a multiple mention in a book like this.
Are you kind of surprised Molly and Jeff, and this is probably inside baseball for some people, so I apologize for the question. People are not going to understand this, but for Molly and Jeff, are you kind of surprised they're still in this power structure in which they exist at this point, having gone through the situation with you and with Angela, but also the huge transition that has happened at Golf Channel as a network from Orlando, Florida to Stamford, Connecticut?
Well, Jeff retired. So shortly after all of this, I think that there was probably a little bit of writing on the wall after all this happened, especially after the Mizuno incident. That's chapter one of the book, and followed up with the remainder of the story later in the book. But I'm sure that there was sort of the reality check that what we're doing here isn't right in terms of the power structure. I mean, it's the clear, what they had going on is a clear definition of nepotism, right? I mean, it's how in the world it was allowed. And I like how you say inside baseball, but just in a nutshell for folks listening, my boss who hired me, the executive producer, Molly Solomon, her husband at Golf Channel was the executive editor. However, when an opening came for somebody to be head of news operations, head of on-air talent, they put him in that role. But in order for him not to report directly to his wife, they had to give him an SVP title. So just think about that. They gave him that so he would report directly to the president. But when you're somebody like me and you upset Jeff Russell, who sleeps every night with Molly Solomon, who's the executive producer, I mean, for lack of a better word, you're screwed. And that's what happened. So my job was safe until Jeff took over that role. And everything changed once he got into that position. And it was just there was a struggle from kind of the beginning, just from his management style that I didn't really respect. It was very authoritarian, even though, look, he wasn't a production guy. He didn't have that background. He was, you know, from the editorial world. Right. He had no business overseeing on-air talent. So it's a crazy twist to the story. I mean, I kind of felt like I was writing a script for Days of Our Lives. You know, because a lot of this stuff you can't make up. Unfortunately, I'm not that creative. So it's an interesting but unfortunate story that I would say is all too common. But I don't think that nepotism side of it's that common anymore. I'm really shocked that NBC allowed that to happen.
Beyond the very obvious dysfunction of having Molly and Jeff being a 1-2 punch, is there anything about Golf Channel that you would prescribe to change to prevent the things that have happened to you from happening to someone else in a similar role?
I think when you have good people in charge, these things don't happen. And I say that because, you know, I'm working now for PGA Tour Live, only, you know, it's a fraction of what I used to do at Golf Channel. But the management is fantastic. They care about treating people right. They care about equality. They care about fairness. There aren't any egos. Bad attitudes are left at the door, because if you come in there with that kind of attitude, you'll be shown the door. I mean, nobody ever says that, but you just kind of know that it's this go into work, do your job, treat people right, and, you know, you'll keep coming back. So I think that I really appreciate now I will say, I think that they brought in Mark Lazarus to run the Golf Channel production side. So I think he reports to Molly, and I've heard nothing but good things about him. So I think that having good people in charge and good people running things will obviously make the whole environment better. And, you know, if somebody said, what's your wish for companies and places like Golf Channel, it's simply just to hire decent people. hire decent people who treat people right, and nobody's going to write a book about you. It won't happen.
Your experience of dealing with filing an EEOC complaint and the seems like the very bureaucratic disregard for it in times. How do you take away, what do you take away from that entire experience and beyond disappointment? And is there something that as a protagonist in this that future people can do to maybe either speed up the process or get the attention of the EEOC better to have a better outcome?
Look, I think that that's the most important question. And it's, I think, the answer that I'm still searching for. And it'll take a lot smarter minds than me to figure it out, and a lot of people coming together to figure it out. What I have learned from this experience is that it is very expensive and daunting and challenging and tiring to take on a corporation. So when you go through the EEOC, for folks who don't learn, and I wanted or don't know about it, I wanted to put this in the book because even going into it, I didn't know about it. I didn't really know what the EEOC was. But so the EEOC basically takes on, from what I've read, 7 to 8% of the cases that come to them every single year, tens of thousands of discrimination, retaliation cases, and they only fund less than 10% of them. And that's important. It's an important number because if they aren't funding it, how can a $30,000 Target manager afford to sue Target in federal court? Think about that, because your best employment lawyers don't work on contingency. They're $800, $1,200 an hour, and you can't afford that. Even for somebody like me who had a good job, once I lost my good paying job, that's a big financial risk to take them to federal court. And so I went the writing the book route because, you know, like my lawyer told me, he said, look, we have a good case. Obviously, we have all of this documentation. He said, but I can't guarantee that a jury's going to, you know, award you the kind of compensation that it will take to cover my fees and everything else. So, you know, that's one thing that I think that in this country that we really have to figure out. The EEOC needs to be better funded so they can take on more cases. There has to be more oversight. HR has to be an independent body. I could go on and on, but I think that these are really important questions for, you know, for our leaders and our legislature and our Congress and our Senate. I mean, these are things that really need to be addressed.
It feels like there is a structure out there that there didn't used to be for whistleblowers, corporate whistleblowers of financial crime, but not necessarily interpersonal crime. And I don't understand why those resources haven't been committed to that, given exactly what you've talked about. And they have to know their own statistics of malfeasance.
Yeah, it has to be out there. And, you know, I did a lot of research on cases like this. And the biggest one that I found was the Pinterest COO who sued Pinterest for discrimination. And she won the case. I mean, she had clear evidence, clear documentation. But again, you're talking about a woman who's in a COO position of a company the size of Pinterest. So she had, what, a 7 or 8 figure income. She Right. can afford the best lawyers in the country. And I guess that kind of goes back to what we're both saying here is that, okay, she can take them on, but most of your cases aren't with people making, you know, $5, $10 million. Most Right. of them are people like me are making a lot less than even what I made. So I don't know. It is kind of, to me, the million-dollar question is how do we make this better? But I do know that the EEOC needs more funding. The last 10 years funding for that department, that organization has gone down, and it went down dramatically during COVID. So that certainly is a big focus for me and something that I will continue to push and try to educate myself and others on.
So to spin it forward from here beyond, working with PGA Tour Live, you've said it has been great. You do a great job with it. What is your kind of hope and aspiration for the next step of your career and then also your life with Sarah?
Yeah, that's my other million-dollar question, I think, trying to figure out what's next. I really am in this sort of in-between position in my life, you know, transitioning out of traditional media and focusing on this book. I mean, obviously, Sarah's playing on the LPGA Tour. She's having a very solid year, and I try to be as supportive in that role, but it's great too, you know, because it keeps me connected to the LPGA and connected to the players who I developed these great relationships with over the years. You know, when I go out and watch her play and see all those folks in player dining now instead of the media center, it's a lot of fun. And I've gotten to know them on a more personal level because I always tried to keep it separate when I was in my role at Golf Channel. I thought that it was important, you know, for me to be able to do that and to do my job the most effectively. As far as my own thing, you know, obviously I'm happy about continuing the work in golf with PGA Tour Live, and I hope to always continue that. I really want to be an advocate in this arena for women and for men or anybody who's had to deal with retaliation or discrimination. It doesn't just happen to women. It happens across the board. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday. Her husband's a baseball coach, and you know, she was talking to me about how she thinks he was pushed out because of his age. So it happens all over the place. But I really care about this. Obviously, I want to use my voice however I can. I want to speak to women as much as I can. I've learned, Ryan, I think more than anything through this is that there is a real fear in women to speak out. And I understand that because you worry about being blackballed in an industry. I mean, I can promise you ESPN or CBS or any of those other, you know, networks, they're not going to come knocking down my door. I mean, because they're afraid of somebody calling you out, because these things do go on. They still go on, as this book proves. But I want to be there for women. I want to be an outlet for women who have been through something like this, who may want to speak out. They want to know the proper route to take, what they can do, what they should be doing personally and publicly. I just think that they're important stories, and I'm always an advocate, not only for their stories, but just people speaking out, because that's the only way that you make things better.
Lisa, thank you for coming on and talking with me. Like I said, the book is a great read. It's a quick read. It's important for people, whether they've been through what you've been through or not, to understand what you've been through. So I think most people can find this easily on Amazon. I think that's how most people buy things anymore, but that's the easiest way to get a hold of this great book, Troublemaker by Lisa Cornwell. Thank you again for being with us.
Thanks, Ryan.